Okay, hi everybody. It's sorry about the delay. I was in a meeting at the university until a couple of minutes ago at the university. I'm sitting in my office, but it was a different program at a different on a different platform. Welcome back to our weekly Pirkei Avot History and Hashkafa, brought to you by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue under the inspired leadership of Rabbi Ariel Constantine. We are now continuing in the second chapter of Pirkei Avot, the eighth Mishnah. We finished the first part of the Mishnah, and we talked about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We talked about his role in the preservation of Judaism in the wake of the destruction of the Temple. I recommended, I think, and if I didn't, I should, that everybody who has a possibility of seeing the movie Agadat Korban, which is a brilliant combination of animation, CGI, and actual acting, which is unusual, with first-rate Israeli actors, describing and portraying the circumstances that lay behind, that took place in Jerusalem in the run-up to the destruction of the Temple. It's not a happy movie, but it's a very moving movie, a very effective movie, and very loyal to its sources, in terms of its sources in Josephus and among Chazal and so on. And I highly recommend it if you have the opportunity. I understand it's still being shown in various places, certainly throughout Israel. And I understand, or it should be, that it is being screened at Jewish film festivals. And if you're living, for those of you who live abroad, really, go see it. Anyways, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, after we discussed the question of why people were created and studying Torah and so on, we get an insight into his students, the people that carried on for him. Now, it's interesting here. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leading surviving student of Hillel in the generation after the destruction of the Temple. He took upon himself the mantle of leadership to shepherd the Jewish people into a time after without a temple. He raised up a generation of students, and nevertheless, maybe it's a discussion we should have later on, another time, insisted that the house of Hillel, his teacher, continue to serve as the official heads of the major institution of rabbinic Judaism as it was being formed at the time. Very striking. He didn't take, he did not claim the crown, as it were, for himself, which I think is raises all kinds of interesting questions about the point of dynasticism and personal achievement in the Torah world. This affects Hasidut, this affects Yeshivot, all kinds of different, and the inheritance of rabbinic positions and so on. But again, it's not for now. In any event, he did raise up five, he describes these five leading students, and he tries to characterize them, and that's what we have in the next Mishnah, or in the rest of the Mishnah. He said, let me see. Chamisha talmidim hayu lo l'Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai ben had five leading students. These weren't his only disciples. These were leading disciples. Eveluhein, and they are, or they were, Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, Rabbi Eliezer the son of Horkanus, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, Rabbi Yosei HaKohen, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, and Rabbi Lazar ben Arach. Those are the five students. Hu hayah moneh shivchem, and he would describe their leading characteristics, their outstanding characteristics, or trying to express very succinctly who these five personalities were. So, Rabbi Elazar ben Horkanus, he says, is a bor sid sheino ma'abed tipa. He was a person, those of you who have ever visited Israel and have gone on archaeological digs or visited archaeological sites know that all of you know that that the country is full, the biggest problem always here was water. So what would happen was people would dig cisterns, And to have an effective cistern to preserve the water, it should remain clean, and it shouldn't sort of evaporate. Not just not evaporate, but also shouldn't seep into the walls. You would dig a hole and you would line it with rocks, and then you would plaster it so that preserved both the quality and the quantity of the water. So, and that way the water wouldn't get lost. Now, these were dug deep in the ground. They weren't exposed to heat. Generally, in fact, if it's a hot day and you're on a teal, the best place to go to sort of cool off is to go where there's natural air conditioning, and that is generally in old cisterns. These cisterns, by the way, in their more modern guise, actually saved Jerusalem during the siege of 1948, because before there was expensive waterworks throughout Yerushalayim. Every house had, or every chatzer, every courtyard had their own cistern, and the water that accumulated in those cisterns was precisely the water that saved that they used. They were able to use when the Arabs cut off the main water line coming from Rosh Ha'ayin. In any event, so he is likened to a cistern which is lined with plaster or lined with lime, which just holds on to everything. In other words, he was known for prison. He never forgot a thing. And he valued, more than anything else, massive amounts of knowledge. In other words, he's a person who emphasized encyclopedic knowledge, preservation of knowledge, clarity, water, of knowledge. And the fact that we're talking here about water, I think it can't be a, I can't imagine that it's a coincidence that he contained, water is, of course, compared to water, because the water is vivifying, the water is the most important part of life, and so it was with him. We're going to come back to talk a lot about Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus in a few moments. Who's next? Next up is Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania was from the town of Pekin, according to tradition, the one town where Jewish settlement has never ceased. It's up in the Galil, in the central Galil. There's a family there that claims to have been there ever since the destruction of the temple. There is a building there which purports to be the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania. She's still around. So if you are traveling in the Galil, please go to Pekin and meet Ms. Margalit Zinati, who is the last surviving member of this family, which never left Pekin. When she dies, she's 120. After her, there is no one who has lived consistently in Pekin all the way back to the time of the Second Temple. She has a cousin who lived in Tveria for a while, then moved back. So if you want to talk about continuous settlement, yeah, Pekin would still have it. the way I understand it, at least the one time I met her, she considers him to be something of a Johnny-come-lately because he had the temerity to leave Pekin for a period of time. But there's actually a nice little Jewish community there at the moment, in any event. He lived in Pekin. He was a blacksmith, according to the rabbis, a person who really worked very hard for a living, not an upper-class individual. We'll see that Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus was very wealthy, came from a wealthy family. One of the leading scholars of his generation, in fact, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua, are the two major combatants, if you want, or ideological or legal rivals or opponents. I mean, it was what we call the Milchamta Shel Torah, a war of Torah, which is supposed for a good reason, but they were the sort of the arguments that obtained between the two of them really fill the literature of the Mishnah and the Talmud. He says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, according to the Mishnah, Ashrei Yoladeto. His mother gets a lot of nachas from him. He doesn't tell us much about him, and we'll have more to say later. Why? In fact, Zev Safra makes the point that it's kind of It's kind of stummy, nice thing, you know, nice pat on the back, pat on the head, but nothing, you know, earth shattering about that. This bit of phrasing. Rabbi Yossi HaKohen is a chassid, a person. We talked about this, about chassidut, that means a person who always tries to do more than he's actually obligated to do. Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel Yerechet, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel is God-fearing or sin-fearing. He always is very, very careful not to get himself in a situation in which he will, in fact, violate the Torah. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was Mayan HaMidgaber, a ever a fountain that gets ever stronger. Number three, number four, we know very little about Rabbi Yossi HaKohen and Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel. They apparently didn't have much of a career after they left, after they studied with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It might be that they passed away young. There's all kinds of, there's just speculation as to why they don't really fill much of a role. We'd have very few traditions from them. We know very little of what they did. The other three, however, are fascinating personalities, and I want to talk about all of them, not just this week. We'll talk about them next week as well, especially as they relate, not only per se, but as they relate to one another. I'd like to start with Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, and by the way, I'm going to be approaching Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus from sort of a different kind of angle than normal. I strongly recommend for those of you who have the books available, I recommend that in the second volume of Rabbi Dr. Benny Lau's book, The Sages, or Chachamim in Hebrew, he has a long discussion about Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, and he also emphasizes just one angle of his story, and I strongly recommend that you supplement what I'm going to say with what he says there. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus was something of an outlier among those who came to study with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Number one, he did not come from a rabbinic family. He did not come from a learned family. He did not come from a family which valued intellectual or academic achievement. He came from a family which was apparently wealthy. It had extensive land holdings and made its fortune, and I emphasize the word fortune, through agriculture. We forget that, you know, we think about Jews doing business all the time. Overwhelmingly, until the Middle Ages, Jews were agriculturists. And anyone, if you're doing Daf Yomi or even Mishnayot or whatever, you see that daily life was agricultural life. It's not as the amount of time that the rabbis spend regulating or discussing business is pales. I mean, it's a lot, but it pales in comparison to to discussions of agricultural activity. I mean, look, I don't know about people in Chutz Laaretz, but I know here, you know, you have a backyard and a Jew grows himself a tomato, and that's like, oh my God. Even though in Israel, I know we went back in the kibbutzim and so on, but still, agriculture still only takes up at this point 3% of the gross national product. But at the time, that was the big deal. So that's what you made your money on. Anyways, his family was a business family. And you can imagine, you know, it would not be anachronistic to sort of extrapolate and say, you know, it's a business family. The father expected, what did the father expect? The father expected that the children would all go into the family business. But Eliezer didn't want to. Much to the chagrin of his father Hyrcanus, and this is the emphasis. This is the piece that Benny Lau emphasizes. He didn't want. He wanted to go and study Torah, and the father was really, really upset. And what Benny discusses is the long and very difficult story of the complicated and laden relationships between Hercules and Eliezer. In the end, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hercules has his money, and he comes a student of Rabbi Eliezer ben Yochanan ben Zakkai. But he's an outsider, and it's really striking what kind of outsider he was. In fact, in a very, very real sense, and I don't mean it in a very real sense, I think that you can see in him he has many of the marks of what popularly we often describe as the qualities of the very enthusiastic and extremely talented Baal Tshuva, a person who wasn't raised. Now, there's no reason to think that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hercules was not raised religious, though it wasn't such a thing. There were people who were not scrupulous, and there were people who were uneducated, and all kinds of stuff. But secularism per se didn't really exist in the ancient period. His tshuva was the fact that he left the world of business and left the world of being an agriculturalist, a farmer, and becomes a Talmud Chacham. And he has to prove himself. And he has to learn, has to prove his bona fides. He has to play catch-up. He feels somewhat, just the way Balei Tshuva do, somewhat insecure. He doesn't know the cues. He didn't go to camp or kindergarten with everybody else. And despite his achievements, he has to carve out a niche for himself. And anyone who has come from the outside and joined the Jewish community, especially the Orthodox community, knows that this is a real challenge. I think many elements of this challenge are expressed in a statement that he makes. It's quoted in the Gemara in Sukkah. And we're going to have this question of Sukkah is going to come up a few times today and next week. In which he asks, he describes what was it about, when they asked him, why were you successful as a student, why were you successful as a scholar, he says as follows, Miyamai lo kidmani adam beveit ha-midrash. When it came to coming to the Beit Midrash to study, nobody got there first. I always got there first before everybody else. I got there before they brought the keys and they let me in. V'lo yashanti beveit ha-midrash, lo yashenat keva v'lo shenat arai. Now, you're allowed to fall asleep in a basement. You're not allowed to sleep in shul. A lot of rabbis don't know that. A lot of balabatim don't know that when they listen to the rabbi. But a Beit Midrash is something of a home. And therefore, you're allowed to nod off. Not really sleep, but nod off. You can eat in Beit Midrash. It's one of the reasons why LP did, by the way. You don't put, technically speaking, you don't put a mezuzah on the doors of a synagogue, of a sanctuary, because mezuzahs only go where you live, and the things which characterize where a person lives, where they eat and they sleep or they study and whatever, and all of those things are not supposed to take place in shul. A base medrash, on the other hand, is a study hall. You're allowed to eat in a study hall, and learning is a mark of living, of dwelling, and therefore you put a mezuzah in front of on top of Beit Midrash. Anyways, he never fell asleep there. In other words, he maximized every second. He was so disciplined that he maximized every single moment to study. He never fell asleep. His adrenaline was that high, and this is the year before, the age before coffee and caffeine, and whether either a matter of a sort of a cat nap or whatever minds falling asleep. And I was the first to come, and I was the last to go. And I never shmoozed. I never sat there wasting my time. Talking about silliness, about things, just even everyday things. I was always. He was totally around. You'd say in Yiddish, you would say as given a reingetan in Lernen. He was totally consumed, totally immersed in his in his study. And so aside from being a mark of piety, the truth of the matter is, this is also the sign of a person who's playing catch-up. He doesn't have time for that. Now, again, it can be a sign of piety and of seriousness as well. A friend of mine many years ago told me that they once asked Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, Rabbi the Chatam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, one of the leading lights of certainly of Hungarian Jewry, of Ashkenazic Jewry in general, how long did it take you to become an outstanding, tremendous Talmud Chacham? He said, it takes 5 minutes. So he said, really, 5 minutes? Yeah, every single 5 minutes you have, you learn. There's a wonderful video. There's a series in general that's available on the site for Arutz Srim Channel 20 in Israel, which is about to become Channel 14, about great rabbinic scholars. And one of them is over Rav Avadya Yosef, and Rav Avadya describes how he was constantly learning. No ifs, ands, or buts. So, yeah, it's not just a mark of the Baal Tshuva, but the Baal Tshuva has this. I've got no time to waste. I wasted enough time. Okay. And then he says, "V'lo amarti davar shelo shamati mipi rabbi me'olam." And I never said anything. I never innovated. I never was creative. I never said anything which I hadn't heard from my teachers. Okay. Now this is very interesting. It means that this statement sheds tremendous light on the significance of the expression borsid sheino ma'abed tipa. He saw his job as to preserve as much of what he learned, as much as he learned as possible. But a cistern is also static. He says, all I want to do is preserve what I've received. Now, in a generation after the destruction of the temple, that's not so bad. That's really actually understandable. But it also betokens a fundamental conservatism. A fundamental conservatism, which will be in marked contrast to the approach to study of his counterpart, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hanania, who grew up in circumstances which are markedly different than those of Rabbi Lezer. Rabbi Lezer, as I said, was from an upper-class family, a wealthy family. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hanania came from very, very modest circumstances. He was a blacksmith, according to Chazal, a person of really even poverty stricken. Although Maimonides makes a big deal about the fact that here's an example of a person who made a living and who made a point of not taking money for his Torah. He did all kinds of stuff to support his family, which is all very true and all very important. But in any case, Rabbi Yehoshua, as we'll see, was a person who believed in creativity, believed in innovative interpretation. Rabbi Elizabeth Horkunov said, no, very, very careful to preserve that which he had received. Now, that's a normal response because if one has reverence for the material that you're studying, if you have reverence for Torah, then A, you want to make sure that you preserve what there is. Number two, in a world which is in a Torah world, in an academic world, where everything remains oral. Nothing is written at this point, don't forget. It's called the oral law for a reason. So the pressure to be precise and to make sure that which you've received is passed over precisely the way you received it, the pressure is intense, and the responsibility is intense. You put that together with reverence, and you can understand very quickly how a borsid sheino ma'abed tipa, a plastered cistern which never loses anything. He also passes on the water, as it were, precisely as the water went in. He doles it out precisely the way it was collected. In addition, perhaps it was because it was his natural proclivity. Perhaps because he thought that was the way to go. As a result, his modus operandi, the way he would go to study, has a lot of lines of similarity to the school of Shammai. Shammai also was a, I think you'd call him a strict constructionist. I mean, I don't know that much about American constitutional law, but from what I understand in terms of the various schools of constitutional law, that there is a thing called being a strict constructionist, which means you hie very closely to the written word to make sure that which authenticates that which you say. And that's what he did. That's what he tried to do. He said, I'm going to be very, very careful about how I interpret things. I'm not going to go too far. I would think he has a tendency to be literal. One of the most striking, really striking things that he says in one place, in Dafka in Sukkah, as I mentioned, is that he says that, it says, the Torah says, Basukot teshvu shivat yamim, dwell in a sukkah for 7 days. So he says, so the Gemara says that he really never left a sukkah. He would check in on Erev Sukkot, and he would leave. He would stay there the entire time, because it says, stay in the sukkah 7 days. And you can make a profound rationalization for interpreting that way. You want to be surrounded by the mitzvah, and you want to be surrounded by sanctity. I mean, all kinds of, it's a withdrawal from the world. It's not a withdrawal from the world. However you want to interpret it. But the point was his caution and his conservatism led him sometimes to be really, 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 really almost literal in his approach to learning. But again, I think that one of the functions here is the fact that I don't want to say he was insecure, but the Baal Tshuva doesn't feel comfortable. You know, his entire validation depends on his teachers. Depends on what he learned from them, because he didn't bring anything to the discussion. And as a result, I wonder. I don't know if this is true, but I wonder whether there is. My impression is that there isn't. I wonder sometimes whether that's why people who are newly come to Orthodoxy, or Judaism in general, tend to be somewhat more conservative and somewhat more cautious, and tend in the direction of encyclopedic knowledge of Torah in the sort of a catch-up than those born into the community. I don't know if that's actually true, but I've counted it. I mean, across the boards, I've certainly counted it enough to know that it is a phenomenon. I just don't know how typical. I think it's certainly true of Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Again, this Shammai was, you know, Shammai didn't have that, and he was cautiously, he was cautious and conservative and a strict constructionist. But at the same time, so it could be both. But I think that it gives an insight that his circumstances give us an insight who this was and why his approach to learning was the way it was. That he's a person who, again, a person who's more cautious, a person who's more doesn't want to make revolutions, a person who's going to always err on the side of the obvious or the more obvious meaning of the verses of the Torah or of the teachings that were passed on to him by Rabbi Nachman Zakkai. And in an age when everything falls apart of destruction and so on, it actually wasn't such a bad idea as a as an educational and as a religious philosophy and methodology. So that is Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. We will have more to say about him next week when we talk about Rabbi Shimon ben Chananya and contrast the two, and then bring into the mix the person who was the most destabilizing individual member of this little chabura, of this little group of five students, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. And in fact, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, in a very real sense, is the polar opposite of Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, and we will see that the contrast between Rabbi Elazar ben Arach and Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus and Rabbi Shimon ben Chananya in the middle is not just a matter of three individuals who clashed horns who locked horns, rather, who clashed in the second century, the end of the first century, beginning of the second century CE, but rather the clash and the contrast between them actually reflect ongoing and perpetual threads and characteristics of the study of Torah and of Jewish intellectual history generally. So that's enough for now, however, and please do share. Please feel free to share this video. It's available always in the daily Shir site of the Tel Aviv International Synagogue. It's on my Facebook page. It's on my it'll be on my YouTube page with all kinds of other content, and there'll be an audio version on yutorah.org. Please don't hesitate to ask questions. Leave comments in the box, and I will be happy to contact me through direct messenger. I will be happy to respond. In the meantime, see you next week. Bye.